From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's Forum program, known as the startup whisperer of Silicon Valley, Bay Area native and LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman joins us to discuss his recent book, The Alliance. In it, Hoffman writes about the new era of employee-employer relationships, and he proposes a model that emphasizes transparency over empty promises of loyalty and job security. He'll join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Well, his LinkedIn profile says he's an entrepreneur, a product strategist, and an investor, but Forbes calls Bay Area-born Reid Hoffman the Uber investor, and others have referred to him as both the king and the father of social networks. Co-founder and executive chairman of LinkedIn and partner at the Silicon Valley venture capital firm Greylock, Reid Hoffman has been a major Silicon Valley investor and serves on many boards, as well as being one of the three authors of a recent book called The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Networked Age, also the author of The Startup of You. And he joins us in studio for this hour. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about your book, obviously, and many other things. We'll talk about immigration in the course of an hour, because you did a piece in the Washington Post on that. But what is with these endorsements on LinkedIn? I have to ask you. I mean, what's the purpose of them? I've been in LinkedIn for years. And I keep it's nice to have these people flooding me with endorsements. But what, I don't know what good it's doing me or them.
Well, so the intellectual idea behind LinkedIn is the ability for someone to put their best foot forward in terms of what are their skills, what have they done. And part of endorsements, which is there's two parts of it. One is single terms, like am I good at public speaking? Am I good at radio interviews? Right? Am I good at coding or managing projects? To equivalent of book blurbs, where you essentially kind of say something about someone is like, look, this person manages project really well, or they're a very good collaborator. Those allow me to establish my reputation with other people, and it's part of my ability to say not just my profile is not just what I say about myself, but what others say about me too.
But like book blurbs, I get all my friends and relatives to do this, right?
Well, although it's also in public. And so what you'll find is that people will very rarely lie. Like if you see an endorsement that says, oh, so-and-so is a nice, a nice person, then you're like, okay, well, but they didn't say I would work with them again. They didn't say they did really well at a project. And because it's in public, it has a higher tendency to accuracy. And of course, it's on the positive side, but it's the best foot forward. The way you check negative information on LinkedIn is you go find people to talk to offline about how they were to work with. So it's a combination of positive and negative reputation.
It's a sort of Yelp approach to
yes.
Occupations. Okay, I get it now. Just wonder what all that endorsement thing was about. And let's get to your book. I mean, you start off by kind of talking about all the downsizing and layoffs that have gone on with this new economic model. I mean, that's fait accompli. That's with us, and it's probably going to be staying with us. But you take that a step forward and you say what we really need is transparency. Start with honesty from the beginning. Like, person's not going to be necessarily there for a lifetime job, and the employer, the manager has to realize that and has to be upfront about it. Yeah. And they are these days to a greater extent because they have to be because people are being laid off left and right.
Mm-hmm. Well, we actually find that we don't think that the conversation very rarely is actually the full honest conversation happening from either side. Now, we think that it should start with the employer saying, look, we recognize that as much as we might want you to work here for your entire life, you may find a great opportunity somewhere else, and that our compact to you is helping you transform your career, is helping you maintain lifetime employability. And in return, you invest in us, you invest in the company. And what we find is that even though there's a lot of the practice that we described in the alliance within Silicon Valley, even here in Silicon Valley, people kind of presume this lifetime employment model from both sides, even though both sides know that that's not case. And so therefore, they're telling each other or not telling each other lies of omission.
So right away, you say no stability, no job security, but maybe also where does corporate loyalty fit into this?
Well, what we suggest is that loyalty is like loyalty of a sports team, not loyalty of a family, and that the loyalty is by transparency and honesty about For example, I'm really investing in the company. When I come to work here, I'm helping the company get stronger in the future. And in return, the company is investing in me. It's making me more employable. It's prepping me for progress in my career. And I may very well end up working at that company the entire time. But by having essentially these tours of duty, these projects that are kind of a fixed, it's not an exact time frame, but it's kind of a coherent time frame.
Well, you suggest 2 to 4 years, in fact.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's actually, and you know, it parallels what happens in Silicon Valley startups, which is generally speaking a 4-year stock vesting curve is part of how people sign up in the beginning.
So this is a new compact you're talking about, nothing short of that. Employee, employer, and it's impermanent, it's mutable. You recognize that from the beginning, but there has to be mutual trust and an investment that's ongoing.
Yes. Well, when most people recognize earlier that you essentially had the lifetime employment was no longer really working either for employees or for companies, this is when you started getting this, you know, free agent nation, you know, one day contracts, et cetera. But that doesn't really work for either side. You have to have mutual investment. You have to have some way by which the companies are investing in employees and the employees are investing in companies. And the right way to do that is this kind of more of an intermediate, this 2 to 4 year tour of duty.
And this is counterintuitive, but you even suggested right away, you say to a new employee, what's your dream job? I mean, what would you like beyond this trajectory taking you somewhere? Give me the illusion of where you might want to be someday. And there may be even some embedding and encouraging of that within the trajectory itself.
Yeah, well, I learned this because it was funny. When I started writing this book and looking at this, our head of engineering and operations, Kevin Scott, told me that one of the ways he interviews people, the first interview he has for them working at LinkedIn is, what's the job you want after LinkedIn? Because it's showing very tangibly he is committed to helping them transform their career, to helping them get to where they want to get to, and that this job at LinkedIn will be transformative to that. And I thought, oh, that's great. I'm going to start doing that too. Because the question is, of course, with our, you know, with many of the folks and maybe even the majority, we want them to work at LinkedIn the whole time, but we want them what is best for them. And so it's that intersection, that mutual interest that's really important.
And then it comes into this whole calculus of what you're advancing here, the idea of an alumni network and the fact that both inside and outside, that network should be built not only inside but outside, and that there is, like you have, if you have this loyalty, you come back to the company, you have this connection with the company, even though you've gone on and moved on to whatever your dream job or advancement might be, and don't think necessarily in terms of, you know, going to a higher level or a higher position or a higher title. Think about the fact that you are almost in a sense wedded to this company.
Yes. Well, it's as opposed to lifetime employment, it's now a lifetime relationship. And one of the things that most people, because they haven't really internalized, they understand that people shift jobs and go to different companies, but how does that ongoing relationship help both the employee and the company? And the notion is with an alumni network, the alumni can help refer customers, they can help refer employees, they can bring in business intelligence. And if you maintain a relationship in both directions, both sides investing in it, it can be very beneficial to both people.
We're talking again with Reid Hoffman, who along with Ben
Kasnoka.
Kasnoka, thank you. I thought that H might be, or that N might be pronounced in a different way. Actually, it's a CH.
Yes.
And Chris Yee, do I have his name right?
Yeah.
Chris Yee, okay. These are all the authors of The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Network Age. I don't know how you work with three authors. I mean, I had a hard enough time doing a book with another author. I know she was wonderful. Let's talk about just how this works and what you envision. And this is really a new paradigm, but it gets down to, in some ways, trading lifetime employment for lifetime employability. I think that's a good axiom. And also gets down to the fact that we're not talking about titles. We're talking about products, projects.
Yes. So the key thing is, and this a little bit relates to our earlier book that Ben and I did with Startup View, which is careers are no longer the, you know, kind of discover your function, you know, go into the bottom entry-level job and work up each promotional cycle. Careers look much more like, you know, a jungle gym, much more like where even if you never start a company, you're being the entrepreneur of your own life. And so the progress is not a question of, oh, did I get the bump up in title? It's, did I get skills? Did I accomplish something? Did I get exposure to an industry? Did I build a network that's useful to me? And that part of the new compact, the alliance, is to say, well, how a company helps an employee stay lifetime employable is, say, well, making sure you're getting access to building new skills, to building new networks, to accomplishing projects that then make you a very interesting employee in the next tour of duty you have in your career.
Silicon Valley, though, all due respect, has a very distinct and in some ways almost insular culture. I mean, the fact is that it's an open culture. It doesn't have these enforceable non-competitive clauses. In fact, you write about co-opetition and Netflix running video services on Amazon's cloud platform because even though Amazon has instant video, it's a direct competitor. I mean, the fact is that you read about corporate life where somebody suddenly leaves and all of these concerns about competition and customers and secrets, you know, they take the keys to the office, they close it down, they can't get back in the building. I mean, these stories are legion. That's what some people would call the real world.
Well, so I think that Silicon Valley presents a very interesting model by which all industries should be thinking about how they're evolving, because we do a great job at innovation here. We do a great job at helping not just participate in the future, but helping create it. And this kind of co-opetition, which is both intense competition and intense cooperation between Silicon Valley companies, and the fact that employees work at several different places is part of what helps make us adaptive. One of the things that people don't
realize— You're still competitors. You're still you know, out for more money for your shareholders. And this reciprocity that you're talking about is faced against the reality of companies that go after other companies and want to essentially defeat them, vanquish them.
Yes. But the short answer is it's both. I mean, I think one of the secrets of Silicon Valley is it's both intense competition, straight out, and intense cooperation, right? So like, unlike other areas of the world, one of the things that happens is that people will be sitting down and saying, hey, I learned this following thing about how to develop software, or this thing about how small businesses are using online services. Or and you just wouldn't be surprised to see a person who works at, you know, kind of Yahoo small business talking to a person at eBay about how they service small businesses online. And that's great. That's part of what helps us create really interesting products very quickly that helps, you know, make the world more interesting.
Somebody goes to another company, though, they can enhance the marketability of that company, enhance the consumer base of that company, and so forth. It represents a threat, doesn't it?
Well, it definitely helps bring ideas, innovation, new work practices, new ways of kind of create, like understanding technology trends. But that shifting between different companies is part of what makes Silicon Valley such an intensely creative place, such an intensely generative place. It's one of the things that helps us create really strong industries. And it's better for the – I think it's better for everyone that it works that way. It makes more competition intense and challenging, but it's but that is ultimately, for example, part of what competition can help in society is it helps create new products and services. It helps create new industries. And this is actually ultimately beneficial to society.
You're talking about an open and transparent ecosystem, essentially.
Yes.
And does this require a leap of faith?
Well, I think it requires some leap of faith. I mean, just like, you know, for example, if most people quote Adam Smith, but they don't go back and read him, and part of his question
about—
Which
is a shame, by the way.
Which is a shame, because The Wealth, it's an awesome book. And part of the thing is you say, well, what they didn't realize is he spent a lot of time kind of in the theory of moral sentiments and thinking about, like, well, does it, if we only focus on commerce, does that change all the nature of these human relationships? And the answer is, it does. You have to be careful about it. You want to be as human and emotive and as connected and full spectrum as possible. But similarly, like competition, it's like, well, does competition make you inhuman? Does competition, you know, kind of all bring it down to the bottom line? And you say, well, it has. There's pressure to go that direction. But competition also generates people trying to create new things, to innovate, to take risk, to build new industries and to work really hard. And those have positive impact.
How transparent really are the companies in Silicon Valley? I mean, there's been accusations of salary rigging, all these kinds of things with big Silicon Valley companies. There's a lot of secretive stuff that's going on. People go on to another company and, you know, these files have to be destroyed and that sort of thing. I mean, this is the business world that we live in, isn't it?
Well, I think the salary rigging is a travesty and should never happen, and it's a bad instance. And that's an instance of non-transparency. Part of the reason why, you know, we advocate transparency is it's much better for this to be on the level and above board, you know, in every vector that you can be. Now, there's secret plans for companies and, like, you know, your strategy and what product you're releasing. And that's, of course, all a natural part of business. But I think that the
and then you go give the blessing to the person who goes on to the next company, and he's still part of the company spirit and so forth, even though he's gone and been privy to those secret plans?
Well, I think part of the culture that we generally do, there's exceptions and there's breakage, but I think it's we create such a better world with allowing this than not that I think it's a good thing to have. But essentially, the culture is, look, you go to another company, you don't reveal secrets in the company, you don't reveal secret plans, you don't reveal, you know, product strategies and other kinds of things that are essentially corporate internal information. But you do say, well, I learned the following thing about software development, or I learned the following thing about marketing, or I learned the following thing about, you know, kind of how mobile is going to be transforming the world as a general technology, and those are applicable here. And as long as people exercise the right kind of morality, discretion, intelligence in this, it becomes massively generative.
Sounds idealistic.
Well, I think we're optimists when we're trying to create the future in a good way.
Well, you're also changing the language to some extent. You say these companies shouldn't say you're a member of the family. You should think of it in terms like tour duty for instead of lifetime job. Think of us as a team. And I guess this comes from Reed Hastings and Netflix. Mm-hmm. This whole concept. I was thinking about, you know, a team. Somebody's playing for the Giants, and then suddenly there's trading going on now, and free agency and so forth. They wind up on another team. They take a lot of secrets with them to that other team. I mean, in terms of not only what goes on in the locker room and everything, and they're there to win. I mean, there is an analogy there.
There is definitely an analogy. And part of being a team rather than family is a team has performance. I mean, there are secrets. But on the other hand, by the way, part of how companies can get old is when they only focus internally and they don't have new blood, they don't have new things coming into them, they don't adapt to the future in the right way. And part of having this kind of participating in the network around you is what helps you innovate and adapt. And if companies get too inward focusing, eventually they start dying. And that's terrible for the company, terrible for the employees, terrible for our society, which needs jobs and industry and so forth. So that's the reason why focusing on what you can create rather than preserving, you know, every secret is what's much more important.
Getting a lot of Facebook comments, probably no accident since you're the guest here, but I'm just this from Andy, and I wonder if you agree with him. He says, treating employees like family is exploitation, plain and simple. Unless you are a worker-owned cooperative, it is a professional relationship in which one person trades their labor in return for compensation. Attaching other emotional strings benefits only the employer.
Well, actually, so I'd said 85% agree. The thing I think is different is I think that in a team, there is loyalty, there is emotional connectivity, there is a mutual belief. It should be done in a transparent and open way, which is both sides understand that, you know, after a tour duty, the employee might go on to do something else. The company may shift directions. This is but by having an honest conversation about it, you can actually have those kind of a genuine connection.
We're talking with Reid Hoffman, co-founder and executive chairman of LinkedIn, also co-author of The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Networked Age. And let's talk about, I mean, you talk about network literacy and network as your identity. Network becomes central core to this whole really paradigm that you're presenting to us. So what do you mean network is our identity?
Well, so let's see. So the first thing is in a connected world where everyone's connected, it isn't just what you say about yourself. It's what everyone else says about you. And there are many good attributes to this. So, for example, if you're good at being a good collaborator, at keeping your word, at delivering what you say you'll deliver, at keeping integrity in terms of honesty and keeping secrets when you need to keep secrets, then people know that about you and other people can then say that about you. And because those conversations that other people have about you are now much more discoverable, your reputation, your identity is essentially what is the conversation about you. And that's hugely positive when you take a kind of a – like an economist, a game theory part of it is the person who collaborates well then gets promoted well, then gets better opportunities, then gets people who want to collaborate with that person. And so – So this is what I think is essentially your network identity is your identity in the modern world.
Let me talk about your identity for a moment.
Yeah, please.
Because you were a student of philosophy. You went to Stanford and Oxford, actually studied symbolic systems at Stanford, like Marissa Mayer, and wanted to be an academic largely to feel you had some impact on the world. Now you're in Kiva, which does some great work and doing things that Is this a book to proselytize? Is this to have that impact on the world? Is that why you want to do this book?
Very much. I mean, part of what we were realizing was how do you – the world has to be in a way that companies and employees are investing in each other. It can't be a one-day contract. It can't be a kind of like, hey, you know, only if you have the skills right now is the only time that it actually ever works for employment. And so we're saying, well, but actually Silicon Valley has some insights into this, and this is something that if the world moves to, it's better off for all the employees and for all the companies and for society at large. And so if they – we thought that the practical tips like we have in the book, how to have the conversation, you know, why managers should start the conversation, you know, these sorts of things, we think we can make employment work better.
Is the book more for managers than it is for employees?
I think it's more for managers, although I think for employees who are either interested in good management or kind of how becoming managers or how companies should operate, it's useful for them too. But the primary thrust of the book is here's how managers can build much better relationships with their employees.
Well, there's some rather interesting ideas that are advanced for employees. I didn't know anything about, for example, Andreessen Horowitz actually allowing for rumors to be paid. Mm-hmm. Best rumor, get money for that, or network lunches to be paid for. I mean, these kind of ideas sound like they're going right to managers, but, you know, from employees, pretty good deals, really.
Yes. Well, and for example, when a company, say, for example, LinkedIn or others, goes to its employees and says, look, we want you to be able to pay for lunch when you're having lunch, not just when hiring a client or hiring an employee, but when you're actually generating network intelligence for the company to help make it adaptive. That's something that's useful to the company. It's also useful for the employee. And it's this mutual shared interest that is where great things can happen. And that's part of what we're trying to do in the book is to show when you say we are allies and you actually take both interests into account, both really benefit.
Talk about the benefit to some of these companies you mentioned that have benefited from alumni affiliations, Booz Allen Hamilton, the McKinsey Company.
Yep. Well, so some of the most advanced institutions that have really paid attention to the value of alumni networks are a combination of the elite management consulting firms like, you know, McKinsey, Bain, you know, Booz Allen, and also universities because they said, well, actually our alumni are our lifeblood and it helps us understand what's going on in industries. It helps us get clients or donations in the case of industries. What other companies need to realize is that's now true for all companies. It's not just true of the management consulting firms, not just true of universities, but it's true of any company that has a number of alumni in it. And that's and part of what alumni can do, like for example, you know, we get like for example, we have alumni group for on LinkedIn where I get insight into how business news is evolving, insight into what's happening in mobile, because people who have gone onto the diaspora are sharing not any company secret information, but a perspective on, well, here's what business news in the new era of mobile phones will mean.
Our guest, Reid Hoffman. You can talk with him and you can respond to what you're hearing here. He's known as the startup whisperer of Silicon Valley. He's a Bay Area native. He's also co-founder of LinkedIn and joins us talking about his new book, The Alliance, written with a couple of other co-authors and writing about the new era of employer-employee relationships, proposing a model which emphasizes transparency over empty promises of loyalty and job security. Join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Hear from managers and employees. Hear from people who have some response, but also you may want to bring in a question or comment. And you can do that also by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. A lot of comments coming in by Facebook, too. You can do that, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll return. We'll hear from you. The book again, The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Networked Age. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with the chairman and co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, here with us in studio, author of The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Networked Age, and certainly want to get your responses and hear from you. And you can join us by calling our toll-free number. Again, it's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. He's also the author of The Startup of You and also the author of an article that appeared in The Washington Post, which I did want to at least broach and talk about with you, Reid Hoffman. There's an article that came about when the Senate was deciding on an immigration bill, and there's been a lot of editorials, and yours is one of them, very passionate in favor of changing the immigration system from what it is. In fact, I don't know if you saw a New York Times piece that was written no less by covering the whole political spectrum, Sheldon Adelson, along with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. And I know you've got this forward.us organization that you're all – what is that exactly? Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of
it? Oh, it's an organization that's dedicated to – and the very first issue is immigration, where it's we are a country of immigrants, and it is both morally and economically correct for us to improve and reform immigration policy.
And that was essentially the tenor of the article. I mean, it was in praise of immigration, and you use such things as you're more likely to start a business if you're an immigrant than you are if you're native born. I mean, this is statistics that people can actually have access to. High growth companies, a quarter, I'm looking at what you write in the article, from between 1990 and 2001 were founded by foreign born. All of these things, in other words, suggesting how integral not only for entrepreneurial advancement immigration is, but how it serves the public.
Yes.
So what do you make out of the fact that we got thousands and thousands and thousands of people and young people, children, even, you know, babies, toddlers and so forth, coming through this terrible journey to try to escape from places like Honduras and Guatemala and all the crime and all the despotism and so forth. And they want in this country. And there's a great deal of compassion on the one hand. Understandably, also the argument that you make about immigration helping the blood and the arteries and veins of the United States, but also we don't have the resources. The argument comes back: we can't sustain all these people.
Well, I think the short answer is we actually can sustain many of the folks. I mean, you have to have some. It can't just say everyone. You know, it can't just be absolutely everyone, but. We have a ton of resources in the country. A lot of work is done both in the creation of new jobs, new businesses, both high impact businesses. Part of the question, essentially immigration breaks into kind of a high end job and a low end job. The high end jobs are simply the jobs are either going to be here or elsewhere, and they're better if they're here. We create more jobs for restaurants, more jobs for tax accounting, more jobs for everything else. If we locate the high-end jobs here, software engineers, you know, other sorts of folks, it's the whole country is better off the more of those jobs we have here. And then on the low-end side, you know, we could institute a way that says, well, agriculture can't hire essentially. You know, these workers who you know, currently essentially illegally come in. But if we were to do that, then, you know, food would get much more expensive, restaurants would get much more expensive, hotels would get much more expensive. That would be a choice. What's immoral is what we're currently doing, which is we're essentially wink, wink, nod, nod, allowing them to come in, but not giving them any legal protections, not giving them an ability to go to the police when they're assaulted, you know, or stolen from and so forth. And so I actually think that we're much better off saying, no, we should have essentially a guest worker system, but which is say with a path to citizenship that says, okay, if you're going to come here and work here in these jobs that we're essentially implicitly allowing you to do, we should allow that, but with human legal protections, with an acknowledgement that essentially we are a country of immigrants, and we've all come here on that basis at some generation, or most of us. There's the Native Americans, right? But the vast majority in terms of the population, and I think it's the morally right thing to do.
Well, all valid points, but those on the high end are. The argument goes taking jobs away from others who are American-born. Those on the low end are taking jobs from others who came here legally, at least so that argument goes. And now you have – and I'm going back to the border problem that we have that we've talked about on Forum a good deal. You have a lot of immigrants being deported, but many of them coming here, about 85% of them are supposed to go through some adjudication and don't ever go through any adjudication. That's a pretty high percentage. So living here, some of them – young people who are thugs, have diseases. I mean, all kinds of range of sorts of things that the country wouldn't necessarily want to welcome in terms of the lifeblood of the country. And we just don't have the resources, so the argument goes, for really taking care of these people when it comes to medical needs, when it comes to education, and so forth and so on. And so you're saying, nevertheless, we've got to open our borders?
Well, I think that one has to set I'm not an advocate of a 100% anyone who walks across the border, you know, comes in. There's security policy. There's also the question of, well, who will be a net contributor to our society? But the point is on the, for example, on the low end, the question is, we actually, in fact, do allow massive number amount of industry here to employ. We don't, like, for example, if you were simply to say, well...
No, you said it. Wink, wink,
yeah,
nod, nod.
Yes, yeah. Right. And so we should be humane in that regard. And you know, Colbert's testimony in front of Congress was entertaining on this, which is, you know, like, well, look, I went and tried this grape picking job, and boy, I don't want to do that. That's really hard work. I'm not really sure that's taking many jobs away from, citizens who want to be doing them.
Not necessarily grape picking, but, you know, there are people who say, I was working as a waiter, or I was working in a service capacity, or doing labor, and someone who came here undocumented got the job because they were paid less.
Well, and that's part of the thing about saying, look, if we're going to have that system in place, having it more above board, transparent, you know, knowing the right way, because actually, of course, it is important that we employ citizens as well. I'm 100% behind that. Now, on the high end, basically, people are frequently under the illusion that there's any jobs that are being taken from Americans here, at least within the kind of software and the tech industry. You know, most of the firms here open up offices in other countries because they cannot hire enough people here. It's in our
also
interest.
Also because they don't have to pay taxes in many instances.
Well, actually, but the hiring employees has nothing to do with paying taxes. That's a revenue question.
But I have people call in when we discuss this on the air, and they say, I'm out of work. I'm a software engineer. I work in Silicon Valley. I've lost my job. Somebody's working there from India. Somebody's working there from another country who came here on a visa.
Being a founder, an executive, a board member, I can literally tell that every single time we find someone who's qualified for a job, we would hire them, right? In almost all these companies. It's not actually a function of
– And you serve on what, 17 boards?
Do I have well, not 17. It's probably more like 10. But
well, still double digits.
Yes.
Let's bring some callers in, and we'll go first to David. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I'm wondering whether some of this discussion about the ways in which workers and companies can invest in each other is really just talking about human asset specificity, like learning the specific skills that usually arise in a kind of learning by doing fashion as people work together, and in which case this kind of game theory and contracts is very useful in order to get people to really do an upfront investment in learning some cockamamie set of skills to work on some patented technology that can't work anywhere else, and thereby, you know, guarantee performance that someone's really going to invest in the very specific knowledge or needs of a company only if they're going to get rewarded for it.
All right, David, let's hear what Reid Hoffman has to say.
So one of the pleasures of writing a book is you get a bunch of different intellectual feedback. And so there's a thread here that we picked up in the last couple of weeks in talking to folks. And sometimes what happens is companies go, well, we want to train you on our specific device or our specific thing that's only true for us. And one of the things that we think is a kind of a good consequence of doing the alliance is to say that, you know, that may be part of a training, that may be part of how it works. But the part of the compact that a employer that is doing a healthy kind of employment contract should be is, how do I help you be employable, not just here but other places? And so some of the skills that the company should be paying attention to in terms of how the employee is developing are skills that have universality, have transferability, have the kind of thing where, well, other companies would want to hire those skills too. And I think it's some combination of them. And when it's healthy, and the part of the conversation, and this is part of the reason we focus on that the conversation the company should be having is employability and employability in the general market. And paradoxically, I think this is something that's also very beneficial to the company, because as the company has people who are focused on adaptability, who are focused on like kind of like, oh, I could be hired by other places, that will make the company up its game too. So I think I understood your question appropriately, but that's the sort of that's one of the things we've been thinking about doing a post on.
And let me thank the caller and to a Facebook comment from Rich, who says, I agree with the premise, but how does an alliance maintain its drive and cohesion in a growth-oriented culture after it has reached its maturity and more lucrative alliances spring up all around it?
Well, part of the whole point is to say that where great work happens is when it's in a mutual and shared interest between the employee and the company. And so part of what we're saying is recognize is that sometimes for even your star employees, people like we talk about in the book, David Hahn, who is did 3 tours of duty at LinkedIn – at some point, they go, okay, my next tour of duty, my next alliance is better somewhere other than this company. And that ultimately is something that can happen. You may regret it. It may be something that's like from a company point of view, I'd rather you were just working here. But by both sides being really open and honest, it creates really good impact.
We'll bring another caller on. Sue, thank you for waiting. Join us on forum. Good morning.
Good morning. Very interesting conversation here, but I have a question about Reid Hoffman's involvement in local politics here in San Francisco. You and Ron Conway financed a hit piece against San Francisco Supervisor David Campos, who was running for California Assembly against Supervisor David Chu. The hit piece was based on Campos' vote to restore Sheriff Ross Mercurimi to his job after a widely publicized domestic violence incident. His wife came out swinging in support of him after that incident because she realized it was an incident.
Probably an unfortunate way of phrasing, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. The incident was being used to take him out politically and didn't have anything to do with domestic violence. So my questions are, why aren't you financing a hit piece against Supervisor Jane Kim, who's up for re-election this year? How much did you donate to domestic violence before that incident, and how much have you donated to domestic violence programs since that incident? And what's your real agenda?
There's four questions there. There's a lot of questions there. But just actually, I think we're talking about over 2 weeks before the primary election, there was a donation of about $200,000.
Yeah.
Again, Supervisor Campos?
Yeah. So the primary agenda was one of the unfortunate, and I did a blog post about this because I think that negative politicking is an unfortunate reality of the current political system. And there was a bunch of essentially money being raised for attack pieces on David Chu as well. And, you know, to be blunt, I could have put a ton more money into it if I had wanted to. And my judgment was that it was a good thing to essentially balance the scales. And so roughly speaking, the research that we did kind of indicated what kind of money was being spent on negative attack pieces on David Chu and kind of a similar basis. And what I wanted to be was to essentially balance it so that the election would be based on positive merits. And so it was kind of an equal weight. And I do think that domestic violence is an important thing, and I think it's important not to...
Do you contribute to money? Do you give money to...
We do, amongst a number of different causes.
Domestic violence? Okay.
Right, yeah.
I think that was one of her questions.
Yes. And...
what about Jane Kim, who also voted in favor of Mercurimi? Have you donated money against her?
Well, as I said, my specific thing was balancing. You know, I actually think David Chu is an excellent public servant. So he shifted from a Silicon Valley promising career as an executive where he could have made tons of money in order to be a public servant. He's trying to balance social justice and interest issues and integrate them well into a good economic and business and do both together, which I think is really important. And so so I just simply wanted it – I didn't want it to get overweighted by negative attacks on the other side. And that was essentially the strategic goal for what we were doing. And you know, it's an unfortunate reality about politics, which I wish we could all change.
And Sue, I thank you for the call. I'm going to go to an online comment from Shauna. It says, my only issue with the interview questions like where do you see yourself in 10 years or what do you see yourself doing after this job is that I can't help but think the employer is asking a trick question to see if I'll stick with them or just plan on using them as a stepping stone. I just can't trust the employer interviewing me to have my best interests at heart. How can one truly tell if the employer genuinely cares or is just asking a trick question?
Well, I think it's a a good question, although to some degree, if the employer is trying to manipulate you or use you, you have to think seriously about whether or not you want to be working there. You know, part of our thought is that what happens in
you can't know in an initial interview.
You can't know in an initial interview. But you know, part of it, like, for example, one of the reasons why Kevin Scott asked this question is because he's trying to show, and he's genuinely interested, B, he's genuinely committed, and C, he's also trying to show, look, I am so interested in how we help transform your career that we're talking about it from the get-go. And that's useful information for the prospective employee.
Riley writes, how has investment versus revenue changed how we think about success in Silicon Valley? We have big companies considered successful and full of pride that have never made money. Does this lead to false hubris in business leaders thinking they know what they are doing when they are only benefiting from cultural momentum?
So I'm not sure I fully understand the question, although I think that false hubris is always a bad thing. And part of what we're trying to create a conversation about. We think that these kind of lies of omission by which both employees and managers essentially know that the reality has changed but are not talking to each other creates an erosion of trust. And we think trust is always a good thing. So I'm not quite sure I fully understand the question.
I think you answered it. In terms of just weighing in favor of trust, we're going to get another caller on here. Sally from Menlo Park, good morning.
Oh, hi. I just have some comments and I'll take the answers off the air. So I think that the authors have some interesting ideas. I've been finishing a dissertation in Silicon Valley looking at sort of broader problems. But there's this assumption that the author makes that everyone is connected, and people are connected in different ways. So there's not a single way people are connecting, and that difference is important to consider. The other is that there seems to be this pay-to-play piece of the networking. So, yeah, I can use LinkedIn to connect, but if I want to sort of do stuff with the network that will benefit me, I kind of have to pay LinkedIn to do that. And then there's also privacy, because I'd have to forfeit that private information that used to be between individuals to a third party that's sort of monitoring that. And the third comment is the tour of duty is a really interesting idea, and I think it works well, as all tours of duty do, for sort of young, agile men. But when you look at a population that has older workers, females, minorities that are excluded anyway, it's very hard to jump ship, 4 years out and really succeed in having acceptance and getting a job when the hurdles are so hard to get in the first place. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, those are comments. Want to respond, Reid? First one, maybe there's a hazard of being involved in LinkedIn all these years that everyone is seen as connected.
Well, so I think, so participation on LinkedIn is voluntary. The question is fundamentally to say, what degree do you, you can choose who you're connected to, whether or not you're on LinkedIn, what information you put on LinkedIn. All of that is with the idea to what are things that are beneficial to me. Like if I connect to people that I want to help them and they want to help me, then we can now collaborate and help each other. I put in information so that I can be found, because interesting things might find me, whether or not they're friends looking for expertise or potential company opportunities or job opportunities. And on the network part of it, from the very early days at LinkedIn, part of the, this question as well, is this just trying to reify the so-called old boys network? And in fact, actually, what we're trying to do is amplify everyone's network to allow the network that you have, the people that you have alliances with, the people that you have trust and connection with, to allow you to help each other to improve the folks who, as per the very beginning of this conversation, kind of have a good reputation, have a good, have trust with people. And so we hope to make that network much broader and more available to everyone, available to older folks, available to, all forms of minorities, because it's your ability to develop your network and ability to leverage your network in order to get interesting, economic opportunities.
What about she raised the issue of privacy, though, also of private information and also of equity in terms of race and gender?
Well, privacy was the first point, which is to say that everything on LinkedIn is voluntary. It's not. Nothing is shown on your profile or anything else without your saying, "I want this to be on my profile." And I think it's generally speaking, all that information is good for you. Most people should put a lot more information on the profiles. It's better for them, but it's their choice. And so that's why the in terms of the answer to privacy, and then in terms of equality. You know, that's part of what we're trying to do is say by having a broader tool by which it's easy to say, oh, so-and-so knows so-and-so, and I can reach out to that. And I can ask them for an introduction. This is something that then becomes much more of a democratic and meritocratic tool and hopefully begins to answer some of the inequality questions.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking to Reid Hoffman. He is one of the co-authors of a book called The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Networked Age. And Russ writes, and this is an important point, please note that revealing trade secrets to a new company is illegal. Thank you, Russ.
Yes.
Absolutely true. An email from Charles who writes, great show. However, I feel that the model proposed only works for highly skilled employees who possess strong sets backed by a good education. If you're an engineer in the Valley, it's applicable. If you work at a retail store making $10 an hour, the model is simply not applicable.
So this is another good conversation thread that I think has come up around the book and, you know, is useful for creating a dialogue. I think this is where two things. So one is I think this is where generally all industries are moving, some more fast. I think the high-end jobs are moving much faster to this. I also think that it's important as a model from the viewpoint of how do you – I think more and more jobs are going to require skills, and how do you facilitate the creation of those skills, the development of those skills, and this mutual investment framework is the way to do it. And so I think it does apply more on the high end than on, you know, like kind of elite jobs or highly skilled jobs or highly jobs of high education than on the low end on this side. But I think everything is moving in this direction, and I think the framework is useful for investing in creating skilled workforces.
It's what we used to call the new economy. David writes online, I started my career at Motorola in the 90s. Companies used to spend on employees' development. I recall a case when a junior engineer obtained an MBA from Kellogg at company cost. Nowadays in Silicon Valley, with some companies having assets of hundreds of billions of dollars, do not get do a fraction of that. How could an alliance be built if there is less partnership toward individual growth?
So I think that the highline question is to say focus on the areas of mutual interest. So focus on the areas where you say, well, if I'm doing this project or I'm learning these things or I'm building this network, here's how it helps the company. Here's how it helps the employee. And that both of them are thinking about solving that problem together. And so whether or not there is high growth or high economics, I think the framework works in the whole range of it. And that's the short answer.
Here's a listener who has some strong agreement with you, I believe. He writes, the company line might be don't leave with our secrets, but it's people, not companies, who make decisions and shape culture. What I found as a manager in Silicon Valley is that if an employee leaves a company, then I truly wish them well. It's in my own self-interest to have an ally in another company. I still have lunch with old employees and learn from them, get introduced to new technologies, people, investors, opportunities. If the employee just stayed with me in my company, I wouldn't learn as much from them.
Exactly right.
A listener brings up, like your thoughts on this too, because we've done programs on it, ageism in Silicon Valley, and this listener says it's economically and morally wrong. What will Silicon Valley do about this rampant bias? And it is a bias.
So I think it's important to kind of, how would you put this? It's super important to have kind of good economic opportunity across the entire range, range of age, range of race, range of gender. And I think that the question in terms of companies is that if companies are kind of actually really focused on keeping the lifetime employability compact, where the skills is relevant, where the things that you're knowing, that should help address this problem some, because you say, okay, the 50-year-old feels discriminated against the 22-year-old. Well, part of that is a question of, you know, companies have an economic interest and what is the skills? What is the ability to do the work? And if the skills have been amplified, have been developed, have been adapted to what the new world is, then I think that that is at least a partial step as an answer to that problem. I do think it's an important problem. I do think that there's some reflexive biases that the companies need to improve. But I think that companies also have an economic interest in having people who know how to do the work.
Well, I think your point is quite salient, because in many cases, what seems like a kind of bias against older people simply has to do with the fact they don't have the skills.
Yes. And so the company should invest in making sure the skills are there.
Again, good sentiment. Peter in San Bruno writes, companies rarely divulge the salaries they pay to all employees. This immediately creates a feeling of distrust. Mr. Hoffman, how can we change this?
Well, one of the tricky things, I've thought about this question, it's a small but important one, is that people also treat their salaries as private data and kind of personal. And so Generally speaking, I think if all of, you know, if you can have a company culture go either way, either saying, okay, actually here we're treating it as kind of individual and it's an individual, it's a private piece of information, the individuals can elect to share or not, which I think is the way that most companies go, or one could create a company saying, we're actually going to be completely public about this, and that's the culture you choose to work in. I think you have to do that from the beginning if you decide that you want to go that way, because in fact everyone has to kind of opt into that. And it's not just the company choices here, it's the individual choices and their privacy as well.
Okay, we've got little time left. I want to know about this division of labor, three authors. How did that work? I mean, particularly in terms of just sharing the labor.
Well,
the alliance of it.
Yes, the alliance. So we had a tour of duty writing the book. Well, the short answer is it actually helps a creative process very well, because all three of us bring ideas, all three of us bring challenges, and all three of us reread the manuscript going, is this right? You know, are we doing the right thing? Is this an accurate thing? Like all these hard questions about, like, is it Silicon Valley only? Is it high skill, low skill? You know, these all came up in the conversation, and we tried to make sure that the things we were saying were a positive step forward, that even if we didn't get everything right, that the concepts and the perspective help evolve the workplace. And so, you know, we all worked on the manuscript together and we'd produce drafts and we'd come together and we'd review them. And we hope that the end product was so much stronger for it.
You want to mention your two co-authors once again?
Yes, Ben Casnoca and Chris Shea, who...
And Ben Casnoca was the co-author with you of The Startup Is You.
The Startup
of You.
Startup of
You, yeah.
Yes.
And this new book, again, is called The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Network Age. Reid Hoffman, co-founder and chairman of LinkedIn. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And you can also let us know what you think of what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our senior editor is Dan Zold. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.